If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
There's no time to kill between the cradle and the grave. Father, time still takes a toll on every minute that you save. Legal tender's never gonna change the number on your days. The highest cost of living's dying, that's one everybody pays. So have it spent before you get the bill. There's no time to kill.
Welcome to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Inside Tennessee is sponsored by the Tennessee Action Council, an educational organization dedicated to restoring constitutionally limited government and the Judeo-Christian values that made our country great. Visit our website at tn4action.com. That's tn4action.com. The phone number to call in and join the conversation is 718-305-7176. That's 718-305-7176. Thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight. We have some good guests lined up. We have Kevin Kukici, who is the founder and president of Lynchpins for Liberty. Kevin was actually the first person to testify before the House Ways and Means Committee last year in reference to the IRS targeting of conservative groups. And so we're going to have Kevin on. He's going to talk about his organization. He's going to talk about his lawsuit against the IRS. He's being represented by Jay Sekulow of the American Center for Law and Justice. Honored to have Kevin tonight. He's been on a lot of big-name shows. He's been on Laura Ingraham show, Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, and many other shows. And so we're looking forward to talking to him and seeing how things are going with his lawsuit and how things are going with his organization. And then a little later on, we're going to be very honored as well to have Representative Judd Matheny. He's going to give us an update on the latest, and let me see if I can say this right, Joint Advisory Review Committee, I think is what it is. Essentially, the Balance of Powers Committee is what we call it. It's in regards to 10th Amendment issues, and I probably still murdered that name, and I apologize. Somebody that I know is screaming out there at me right now. Anyway, they had their second meeting on the 12th of November. Fiscal Review Committee was supposed to look at everything in regards to the cost of the refugee resettlement program. And, well, let's just say that the numbers were not complete, but we'll get into that a little more when we talk to Representative Matheny a little later on tonight. And we're going to have some time in here in between that, between talking to Kevin and talking to Representative Matheny. And primarily, I'm going to spend that time talking about the textbook issue in Tennessee. Of course, it's not just a Tennessee issue. We have the same problems in most of the other states in our country. But I want to read to you real quick something that you may or may not be aware of. And this goes to show that, you know, this is just not a few people on the fringe here that are concerned about textbooks. There's a lot of concern. And this is a letter that was signed by Senator Dolores Gresham, the Senate Education Committee, and Mike Bell, the chairman of the Senate Government Operations Committee, and dated November 6. And it is to Chairman Fielding Ralston, the Tennessee State Board of Education. Chairman Ralston, on November 4th and 5th, the Senate Education Committee, along with invited members of the Senate Government Operations Committee, held hearings on the textbook review process and the role of the state's textbook commission as currently structured by statute and rule. The meeting grew out of questions and issues raised at the commission's June 19 sunset hearing, conducted by a joint subcommittee of the GOC. The several hours of testimony brought to light and confirmed many of the same issues raised in June. The process design is flawed. Corrections must be made. Troubling revelations came to light, both oral and written testimony, which described inaccuracies, biases, and outright fabrications in many of the social studies textbooks reviewed in the current cycle. Over 500 pages of public comments detailing these concerns are available for review on the Department of Education's website. Astonishingly, notwithstanding the Commission's knowledge of major discrepancies in fact and presentation, the current list of proposed text was nevertheless approved by the State Board of Education on October 25, 2013. Putting these textbooks in the hands of our children would not be in the best interest and is completely unacceptable. The State Board of Education and the State Textbook Commission were created by the General Assembly. It is our responsibility to fix problems when we find them. These are serious matters that require our attention and action in the coming months. In the meantime, we strongly encourage the Board to reexamine the use of the approved list of textbooks, and we welcome your input and suggestions moving forward. And it's signed by Senator Dolores Gresham and Senator Mike Bell. And you know, the story about how we got to this, how we got this letter, and not try to take anything away from Senator Gresham or Senator Bell. I appreciate their comments, appreciate their interest and concern and efforts. But, you know, the reason that they even know about this is because some average citizens who, I guess you could say, have above average concern for our children and for our country and for what our children are learning about our country took it upon themselves to make this issue. They'd heard some things. They knew there was the textbooks were being reviewed. They started doing their own digging. They saw things that concerned them. So, you know, I think they would probably agree with me, at least some of them, that politics and the future of our country, certainly the future of our children, aren't way too important to be trusted just to politicians. We have to get involved. And these average citizens took it upon themselves, and they have made a difference already. The fight's not over by any means. They'll tell you that themselves. But anyway, we're going to come back to that a little bit later. Just wanted to kind of give you an idea of the topics for tonight. Well, I believe we have Kevin on the line now with us, and we'll go ahead and get the conversation started. Kevin, how are you tonight?
I'm doing fine, David. How are you?
Doing fine, doing fine. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me so much.
Well, let me just go ahead and get started here. Let's talk a little bit before we get into the actual lawsuit issue and you're testifying before the House Ways and Means Committee. Lynchpins for Liberty. Let's talk about your organization a little bit. Can you give us a little background on it?
Sure. Let me give you a little background. I always find it helpful. I actually began Lynchpins of Liberty as an inspiration from a friend of mine, a historian at the Heritage Foundation by the name of Lee Edwards. And he tells the story of how in 1965 he was campaigning with Ronald Reagan for governor of California. And one afternoon while they were returning from campaigning, they returned to the Reagan's home in Pacific Palisades, California. And while the future president and his wife were in the kitchen preparing lemonade and cookies, Edwards meandered into Ronald Reagan's personal library, and he discovered, much to his delight, that virtually all of Reagan's library was comprised of works of philosophy and government and history and economics. But he was curious, so he approached the shelves and began pulling down books and discovered immediately that the books were no mere decorations, for the pages had been dog-eared and the phrases were underlined and certain annotations were contained actually in the margins of the book in Ronald Reagan's own handwriting. And Edwards, keep in mind, by the way, that this was a year before Reagan was elected governor and 15 years before he was president. Conventional wisdom at the time, as you may remember, was that Ronald Reagan was an uninformed B-movie actor. But Edwards' journey through his personal library that day confirmed his suspicions about one of the greatest presidents in American history. And he did two things. He wrote in his diary, first thing he said was, "President Reagan?" question mark. He had the foresight to see 15 years in advance what kind of a leader was being built. And the second thing he said was, here was a library and the thought of a man who had come to his conservatism the old-fashioned way, through study and reflection, one book at a time. Well, that was significant in the development of my own political philosophy, because I wanted to read and to know every book that Ronald Reagan had read, and I wanted to know his philosophical mentors. And it led first to the expansion of my library. And with the expansion of my library, I began to dig deeper into the roots of our moral and constitutional order than any time in my 20 years of formal education. I'm an attorney by trade, but never through kindergarten, through high school or college or law school had I ever been exposed to the right books. And so the journey then extended. I began it by inviting friends of my seventh graders, when my own children, I've got six children that we homeschool, and when my oldest reached the seventh grade, she invited some of her friends, other homeschoolers, into our home, and we began studying Western civilization focused on Russell Kirk's book, Roots of American Order. And that happened with each of the first three of my children, and then began teaching in the community, and always would ask the question of the students, what books are you reading? Because you can tell a lot about a person. It gives you a little bit of a window into their soul when you know what books are important to them or what books were inspirational to the development of their own thoughts. Eventually, we gave the name and the organization a name called Lynchpins of Liberty. I wrote a little book to outline and develop the method and the marketing plan. And then we began to host events and raise money. And then this is where we got to January 2nd, 2011. So all that had preceded that time. But on January 2nd, 2011, we filed our application with the IRS seeking tax-exempt status as a 501c3 educational organization. And we're an organization that's aim is to develop the moral imagination through the study of history. We believe that God is the measure of all things, that the soul is the essence of humanity, and that without order in the soul, there can't be order in the community. We recognize also, however, that the state, and I mean that with a capital S, the government is God-ordained, necessary to protect against foreign enemies and to maintain domestic security and justice, for there can't be any freedom without the law. But there are limits
right.
to the state's authority, and the government cannot be a law unto itself. And so as you and I talk here today on the phone, I am now almost 35 full months from the date that I filed my application, and the IRS continues to unlawfully obstruct and delay my application for tax-exempt status.
And I'm sure that has nothing to do with the fact that you're a conservative. And anyway, speaking of conservatives, if you love conservative internet radio as much as we do, then you already know about the Grit and Grace radio show. Jennifer Meadows has been carrying a conservative message on the net for years, and now she's on conservativenationmedia.com. Join Grit and Grace every Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central for solid American patriotism, unapologetic commentary, the latest news and conservative analysis with a good dose of plain old-fashioned fun. That's Grit and Grace every Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, right after A Just Cause Coast to Coast with Sam and Cliff on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. And we're speaking with Kevin Kukagee of Lynchpins for Liberty. And, Kevin, so you filed your application for 501c3 status in, you say, January of 2011?
Yes, sir.
And how long before you heard anything good, bad, or ugly from the IRS?
Well, we didn't even receive our first response until May of 2011, which was already at the edges of the latest that it would take. Prior to 2010, the IRS would approve a C-3. The average time it took was between 2 and 4 months. Well, it was 4 months before we even received our first response. And I knew immediately that we were under attack because the letter contained 90 inquiries of intimidation, including those intended to force me to disclose my donors.
90? Did you say 90?
90 over 7 or 8 pages. These are multiple subparts of questions. Prior to that point, prior to the Tea Party attack, the types of questions that were asked were administrative in nature, usually 3 or 4 or 5 questions on a page, you know, asking you whether you have done your state paperwork, is it consistent with your federal paperwork, do you have a conflicts of interest policy, really benign questions of that nature. But these questions were all political, or virtually all political. They wanted to know, they wanted me to disclose the identities of the students that I was mentoring. And these students, many of them were minors. Can you imagine what the parents would have done if I would have taken the children that they had entrusted to me and turned their names over to the IRS? And to what end? Why does the IRS need to know that? They wanted to know my members, my donor base. They wanted to know where I was teaching these students. They wanted to know my own political views on every issue. I mean, where would I stop? And then they even asked
Good
for me
Lord.
To give the political affiliation of my own mentors. So clearly I've been singled out by the content of my speech.
Yes, no doubt. 90 questions worth. Good Lord. So what did you do? What was your first step?
Well, when it first happened, I felt like it was the world against me. We didn't know that everybody else was getting similar letters, although I did recognize what was happening. And the journey began like this. I began telling people in my closest circles, and the people that I was speaking with were people that think like I do and that see the world the same way that I do. And even they were hesitant to believe what was happening. I remember one very good friend of mine, he rolled his eyes a little bit, and he got a little bit hesitant and backed off. And I knew, I said, I'm not going any further with this. He thinks I'm a conspiracy theorist. The good news on that, gentlemen, is that about 2 years later, just this past summer, he took me out to lunch, and he apologized profusely for ever doing that. He said, Kevin, I didn't believe you when you told me. I said, I know you didn't. I said, that's why I didn't push it anymore. But he said, not only has the government done what I had believed they were doing, he said it's worse, and it's caused him to now question everything the government does. So if there's any silver lining to that cloud, it was that it opened up his eyes in a new way. But here's the important part of the journey. So this was May of 2011. I answered as best I could what I believed to be non-violative of my constitutional rights. I objected to the things that I thought were violative of both written law and constitutional law. But I filed my answer, and I tried to reach the IRS to get answers to some of my questions. You know, when you get these letters from the government, they put an agent's name on the paper, they give the agent's phone number, yet every time I tried to reach an agent, I got a voicemail. I left countless voicemails, got this hole in the file, no answer, no answer, no answer. This went on for 6-7 more months until December of 2011. During this time, however, I received and then lost a $30,000 grant that I was given by a reputable nonprofit whose executive director advised me that never in his 25 years of making grants had he ever seen a nonprofit treated this way. He knew the stats. He knew, look, your application is sound. This usually gets turned around in 2 to 4 months. I don't know what's happening here, but we can't keep this. They had made the grant contingent upon me getting my letter, thinking that my letter would be coming right around the corner, and it went on for so long that I said, look, you're gonna have to reapply. So I finally got a hold of an agent in December of 2011, who happened to be in the Cincinnati office, and I said, why is this taking so long? I said, I've lost a grant. I said, people are telling me this should have happened in 2 or 4 months. And he said, plain as day, and mind you, this was before this broke out on a national level, he said, we have been waiting on guidance from our superiors as to your organization and similar organizations. We've now received that guidance, and you'll receive your response on a first-in, first-out basis. Well, I knew right away what that meant, and sure enough, 2 months later, I got an even heavier letter. Some questions they'd already asked, more questions were added. The only good
news
about
that... Before we get to that next letter...
Sure.
Before we get to that next letter, we've got to take a real quick break. Hey, don't go away. We'll be right back on Inside Tennessee.
Aren't you glad the so-called fairness doctrine doesn't apply here?
Molon LeBay Challenge Coins and Wares. Similar to challenge coins used by various military units, these MLCCW coins are ideal for anyone that champions the right to keep and bear arms by highlighting the Second Amendment and the Greek phrase, Molon LeVay, which translated means, come and take them. Come check out our pro-freedom, pro-liberty, and pro-Second Amendment coins and shirts at MLCCW.com. That's MLCCW.com.
Hello, I am Robert Garding of the New Wise Conservatism Radio Show, heard on Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central, through conservativenationmedia.com. Being on the air since 2007 from behind the silver CNN microphone of freedom, we've helped people become more informed to keep socialists out of the White House and Congress. But that work isn't over yet. Tune in Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern on CNN for the New Wise Conservatism Radio Show, the voice of reason in our unreasonable world.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. Call in if you have a question or comment for our guest. Once again, our guest is Kevin Kukagee from Lynchpins for Liberty. He was one of the very first witness before the House Ways and Committee, House Ways and Means Committee, in reference to the IRS scandal last year. The IRS was, as you know, targeting conservative groups, specifically Tea Party type groups. So you received a initial letter with 90 questions about your, basically, we want to know all your political beliefs. We want to know right. everybody who's involved. We want to know who's funding them. You finally got in touch with an agent, and he basically said, well, we're waiting on guidance, how to deal with you and other similar organizations. And then you soon after that received another call, and let's take it from there.
Yeah, well, actually, we received the next letter. And in the next letter, it was a lot of repeat questions that were contained in the first letter, and then they went deeper and more offensive questions. And I remember talking to my wife saying, I knew this was coming. I feel like it's us against the world. But within about 12 hours, it started popping up on the Drudge Report and all across the Internet that hundreds of organizations were getting almost the exact same letter because they were posted online. And I said, that's my letter. I talked to some media at that point. Congressional investigators began the tip of the iceberg of investigation. It did not move very fast at that point, but it became public knowledge. And then for the first time, we started getting legal representation. By the grace of God, Jay Sekulow and the American Center for Law and Justice, an amazing organization, by the way, one whom I have watched from afar for years, even going back to the late 80s when I was in law school. Yeah, I mean, the late 80s when I was in law school was I used to watch Jay Sekulow on television. And so they came to the table, and we had a giant conference call with hundreds of organizations on the telephone, and Jay explained to us that everything we were feeling was indeed true. We were being singled out according to our beliefs and our political views. It's a violation of our constitutional rights. So from that point, David, again, this was by this conversation, it was early March 2012, until May 10th of 2013, which was the day that Lois Lerner issued her apology. That window of time, not a lot happened. We would get ebbs and flows of information, but we hadn't filed suit yet. The ACLJ took on, I think, about 30, 35 cases at that point. You see, it's important to discuss this, too. There were a lot of Tea Party organizations and liberty groups and conservative organizations like mine. A lot of people didn't want to get into this fight with the IRS. They would rather just shut down and go away. So already you see that the IRS is being effective in its aims in intimidating people and chilling speech. But those of us who said, I don't care, well, this is about the point, we will fight the government, we're going to stand up for liberty. There were about 30, a little more than 30 of us in that original group. But the nature of the prosecution of that case was administrative. In other words, the ACLJ took each of our files one by one. They answered the questions, the 90 or so questions each of us got, one client at a time with the IRS. And so this was a lengthy administrative process. I had determined that nothing was going to happen of any substance while President Obama was still in office. But all of that changed on May 10th of this past year, 2013, and that was the Friday afternoon when Lois Lerner had a fake question planted at an ABA event so that she could apologize, quote-unquote, about these two rogue agents, you recall, in Cincinnati who were apparently responsible for all this mess. And they intended that this go away. This is the typical Friday afternoon document dump, and they had hoped that this was all going to be gone by Monday, but everything changed on that moment.
Now, let me ask you, were there any other organizations from Tennessee involved in this?
There are at least two. The Chattanooga Tea Party and Mark West. He's a friend of mine, and we got to know each other this year through this process. And then the Roane County Tea Party. They're both involved in that in Tennessee. So there's three of us at least. There may have been more, but they're not. Those three are on the ACLJ lawsuit. They are plaintiffs with Lynchpins of Liberty. And this battle took on a whole new context on May 10th, because one of the things, as I noted and as everybody knows now, Lois Lerner tried to make it or play it off as if this was just two rogue agents in Cincinnati who had done this on their own. Well, I had immediate evidence that that was not the case, going back to that telephone call of mine in 2011, December. So I began calling people I knew in D.C. I called the ACLJ, who, by the way, had immediate grounds to file a lawsuit once Lois Lerner offered this apology. We had grounds to sue, which we did. But I also said, I have evidence to be able to testify. I talked to an agent who told me that this was not just them. He was waiting on guidance from superiors as to all of these organizations. And that eventually led to my testimony. You know, the media explosion was, it was so big that the following Monday I did some local radio and had intended to talk to my mother just to check in once a week. And I couldn't get to talk to my mother until the end of the week because the media just kept getting bigger and bigger, and it was all over everywhere, you know, from local radio to local television to regional television to national media, national television, national press conferences. It just really overtook things for the next 3 weeks leading up to the testimony.
And so Where are we now? I mean, I know you're not hearing quite as much about it in the news. We've got a couple of minutes here before the break, but where are we in terms of your lawsuit?
Well, let me I want to walk you through some of the things that happened at the testimony and then curl around back to that if we could, because you are exactly right. The media has not focused on this. Obviously, Obamacare is the hot item in the news, as it should be. But these scandals are not going away, and they are not any less significant, despite the fact that media may not want to talk about them. And what we found is, despite the pinnacle of this issue so far has been the day we testified on June 4th, there have been blips along the way when the media gets excited about it again. Like, remember when the Obama administration tried to say that these were all false and conjured up scandals? That brought some more media attention to it. So for a couple of days, it was back on the burner again, and, you know, television wants to talk to you and papers want to talk to you again. And then it goes away, and then they come back around, and the next time it usually happens whenever the president says something stupid that they'll come back and they'll want comment from those of us who are still in the lawsuit.
And that happens fairly regularly then, since, you know, him saying something stupid is a fairly regular event.
You got that right. So if you want
and the sad thing is we have to go ahead.
Sorry? I was just going to say,
go ahead.
I wanted to give you more info about the testimony itself, but didn't. I thought it might be better to do that on the other side of the break.
Okay. Let's assume you're listening to conservativenationmedia.com. You're a conservative. You love America just like we do, and you don't want to get caught short in case the leftist government drops the ball and leaves the country and your family unable to get the basics of life in an emergency. Since that's the case, you're going to want a supply depot to get everything from patriotic gear to survival necessities to outfit and protect you and your family. And your pipeline to those essentials is right here at conservativenationmedia.com. Just go to our website, conservativenationmedia.com, and click on the Patriot Depot banner. That will take you to the world's best-known warehouse for all your conservative emergency survival needs. Wave your flag and be ready for whatever the future holds starting right now. Just go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the Patriot Depot banner to join the conservative revolution, where America always wins. Don't go away. We'll be right back and take a short break. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media.
Hi, I'm Kathy Henners, your host on Daily Roll Call on conservativenationmedia.com. Please join me each Friday as we talk about subjects like the Muslim Brotherhood, their goals, their agenda, and how it affects our schools, our law enforcement, and our communities. As a retired police officer, I'll give you an inside look into this issue and so much more. Don't miss it. Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, right here on conservativenationmedia.com.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1-2-1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is peace around?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're speaking with Kevin Cupici. Kevin, right before the break, we're going to talk about the testimony in reference to your case, your lawsuit through the ACLJ against the IRS. So let's go ahead and get started.
Yeah, so it's interesting, David. Up until the day before our testimony, we testified on June 4th. Prior to June 3rd, all of the media coverage was on what we would call the right side of the media. It was Fox-based, and the radio programs were like Laura Ingraham and Bill Bennett, and it was Wall Street Journal coverage, and it was UK Daily Mail had a story that got on the Drudge Report, and Rush talked about it. It was all what we would consider our side of the media. But on June 3rd, once our names were released to the media, then it hit all aspects of the media, and even the liberal media now was covering it. And so it became a tsunami of media coverage, and it was high profile for about 48 hours, that Monday and then the Tuesday. And so when we began our testimony, you know, it's on national television, it was on C-SPAN, I think it was C-SPAN 3, but Fox and the other stations were still covering bits and pieces of it. And I don't know why the sequence was chosen, but I happened to be the first one to testify. There were six of us that day, and everybody had compelling testimony. But one of the things that people have asked me frequently, what's the take-home or what's the takeaway from that testimony? And, you know, as a lawyer by trade, I've been involved in litigation, and I've been deposed as a witness, and I've been grilled by attorneys, so I understand that part of the process. But what I did not expect in this was that there were Democrats on the committee who, during the moments when I was giving my testimony and I was talking about liberty and I was talking about morality and I was talking about the need for constitutional order that's based on moral order and I was talking about the great leaders of Western civilization, they were chuckling. They were laughing and rolling their eyes. You know, the viewer would not see that because their camera's faced on me when I'm giving my testimony. But it threw me off for 20 or 30 seconds, and I spoke with someone afterwards who confirmed my suspicions, which was, Kevin, they were doing that on purpose. They do that to try to get you off your game. And I said, yeah, I know. I understand that these men and women, unfortunately, think this way about our rights and about our Constitution. But to see them not even in that room, in that hall, at that moment, to be able to show the discipline to refrain from that was stunning to me.
Was it just one or two, or was it several of them? And I'm assuming they were all Democrats.
Yes, the issue here, I've got two issues. Yes, the Democrats were the only ones who rolled their eyes and laughed. But there were also Republicans who were there only for their own agenda. They weren't there to really get to the truth. They were there for their 5 minutes on television. And that's discouraging because you could tell by the nature of their arguments and the nature of their questions that it was about them, it wasn't about us, and it gets very discouraging because you know that their agenda is not to get to the truth. It's for their own political agenda, and that's discouraging.
So now, you know, I know I've been to the legislature a couple of times, and, you know, I've been in a few committee meetings, and, you know, they don't tolerate any outbursts. They don't tolerate anybody, you know, laughing in the background or having sidebars. So you're telling me that at the federal level they hold these committee meetings and you've got sidebars, you've got people laughing, and you've got people being disruptive, and the person in charge of the committee, they don't take control of it?
Yeah, and Yeah, it threw me off. I didn't expect that that would be the case. They do it in a way that they're not so loud in their laughing and chuckling that it makes it obvious, but they do it very deliberately. You see the eye rolls. You see them whisper to each other. You see the chuckles. And, of course, there's 30 people on this committee. They don't all sit there. We had a three-and-a-half-hour our testimony is 3.5 hours long, so they're in and out all the time, and that's distracting as well. But I would say probably 2/3 of the committee were not what I would have expected or hoped they would have been. 1/3 of the committee was serious, 2/3 was not. We still got to relevant issues, and we got it on the record, and that's important, but there's a long way to go in that process.
Right. Now, you mentioned that you weren't that impressed with some of the Republicans, that they seem to be there just for their own purposes to kind of, I guess, be seen and make score their own points.
That's right.
Just your feeling, or is that based on some other information that you had?
When you say just my feeling, I think you could go back and watch the testimony. It's twofold. You can watch the testimony. And then when you get responses from the individuals, we had the benefit, the people on TV don't see, of having had a meeting with some of the committee members prior to the event just so they can tell us what's going on and how it's going to play out, just to teach us the formalities of it. And then we had dialogue with some of them afterwards. And you learn very quickly, because they were expressive about it. They said, look, here's our goal. Here's what we want to accomplish through these hearings. And it would surprise you that their goals were not just to get to the bottom of the matter. They wanted to use it for political objectives, not all of which were bad in and of themselves, but it was a little stunning to me that they were still going to use this for themselves. The rest, I think you can pick up from just watching certain representatives from certain states, and the comments they make point a little bit, and they grandstand a bit. But I'm used to making that judgment because I watch a lot of them, have watched it in the legal practice for a long time, and you sort of get to distinguish that.
Yeah, okay. So when the testimony was completed, what's happened since then? Or is there something else you still need to fill us in on?
Well, the lawsuit, of course, is there's really three prongs to this. There's the testifying, the testimony, and these committees continue. And there are two primary committees, House Ways and Means, which is led by Dave Camp from Michigan. He's the chairman of that committee. They continue to investigate. And then you have Darrell Issa's committee, which is Government Oversight and Reform Committee. And those committees continue to do their work. And there are good people on those committees. I'm not disparaging the whole committee. I'm just saying on that day there were some people who took advantage of it. The committees are doing their work. It's slow. It's really slow. And the speed is to some extent dictated by the delay of the Obama administration. The Obama administration is very slow in releasing their information. And so that's a process which is going to be dragged out for a long time, and only political pressure, and I'm not sure we have the political will for it yet, only real political pressure is going to make that go faster. But the other element is the lawsuit, and the lawsuit is separate and apart from the congressional testimony, although some of the evidence we can then use because it becomes evidence on the public record. But the lawsuit, that is, the wheels of justice are very slow, and I have most confidence in that process because we're represented by the ACLJ, and I also have most confidence in that process because the government is not going to want to provide certain answers to discovery. What they're going to try to do is delay answering to that point for as long as possible for political purposes, to get past the next election, if possible, to delay it until Obama is out of office. But that process, right now, David, we've not even gotten our first substantive response from the administration. We filed our lawsuit in May. We filed two amended complaints since then. We will not get our first substantive response from the government until right before Christmas. So, and even sure. then that will start the process when we have to get. So it's going to be late 2014, imagine, before we start to get to the real nitty-gritty.
Well, now, okay, back to you mentioned Chairman Issa, who seems to be, pretty sharp and seems to stay on these things. How long can they blow him off? Can they really blow him off, you know, until Obama's out of office?
Well, you would think they couldn't, but the number of times they do. And what we find is they turn over documents, but they don't turn over all the documents. You know, they ask for emails, and the government hides emails. The government gives 2% of the emails requested. And it's typical, and this all comes down to political pressure, though. We live in an environment, as you know, where not only does the president violate the Constitution on a daily basis, multiple times a day, nobody's holding him accountable. And it's very difficult to move this, to move the dial without the political will. If we lived in a culture that people understood the Constitution better, understood why it's important, and why what the president is doing in violating the Constitution affects their liberties, they would be a little bit more on fire to insist that their congressmen and senators hold the president accountable. But there's not enough of that pressure right now. We're getting closer to it, but it's generational. And right now, we've got a political class that's exhibiting the courage to really push those buttons to get the president. And the media, of course, is not going to be supportive of that either.
Right. They're not on our side by any means, and not likely to be. It's just, you know, nobody else could get by with this much obstruction of justice in any other venue. I mean, only the political class seem to get away with this much. We're still the freest country on earth, and those of us who love America know that the Constitution is the reason for our liberties. ConservativeNationMedia.com isn't going to let those leftists in D.C. take our freedom away, and our constitutional expert, Matthew Apolosky, is leading the charge. Join Matthew every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central, for Liberty and the Constitution Community to learn about our rights and freedoms under the greatest governing document of all time and what you can do to protect your liberty under the Bill of Rights. The Liberty and Constitution Community with Matthew Apolosky, Thursdays at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. We're speaking with Kevin Kukagee. And Kevin, back to this obstruction of justice, because that is what it is. And you mentioned political will. You know, it just seems to me they could still put enough pressure. I know they're never going to wrap this around Obama. I know that's not going to happen, but it seems to me like we could get somebody pretty high up, couldn't we? Couldn't they keep enough pressure on to get something done about this?
Yeah, well, there's no question. I mean, the evidence that exists in this IRS case alone is far more – there is more evidence in this case of connection to the president, blatant connection to the president, than I think there has been in any scandal. I mean, this is way – this is bigger than what happened with Nixon by far, and yet because there isn't the political will, it's not being pushed as it should. I mean, you have Wilkins, William Wilkins, who is the only political appointee in this matter right now, of the Obama administration, meeting with President Obama April 24th, I believe it was 24th, maybe the 25th, 2012, met with President Obama, was in the White House and the Eisenhower Executive Office Complex for 8 hours. The next day, new issues and guidelines for how to respond to the Tea Party and Liberty groups were issued by either Wilkins or Shulman, certainly at Wilkins' direction. There's a direct connection to the president. There's no question there's a direct connection to the president, and this is where the political will comes in. If we lived in a different time, this president would be going down, but we live in a time where that will not be touched because this president is still worshipped as the god of the, you know, modern-day leftists in the media that carry the water for them.
Well, okay, but let's go back to the GOP. I mean, I know we're not going to win over the leftist media. I know that we're not going to change the Democrats' mind on anything. But I'm just disappointed overall. I don't see a lot of fighters on our side. And whether you're going to win in X amount of time or not, I'd just like to see them fight on this harder and more consistently. Not just this, but everything. You know, Benghazi, I'm not trying to downplay the importance of your issue, but obviously, you know, anytime you lose four Americans, loss of life, we've still got that scandal.
And absolutely.
I don't see the consistent desire. I don't see the desire to fight these things consistently, to stick with them. It's like they come and they go. Now, maybe that's just because we don't hear it from the press, because the press doesn't want us to hear it. But I just discuss it all in all. It just seems to me like we don't have a lot of fighters in the GOP. And
well,
the ones that do
only,
fight, what are they
get knocked down.
They catch flak for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just going to say, as you were suggesting, no doubt, Ted Cruz, one of the few fighters for us, and what happens to him, he doesn't get torn down by the left nearly as much as he gets torn down by the own people on our own side of the aisle.
Right.
It's stunning to me that we are in a time where the Republicans are fighting against those who have courage. Now, I know why they're doing that, because he's upsetting their apple cart, and they have certain goals for themselves, and they all want to run things the way that they're used to running them. But this is liberty. Our nation is at risk more than it's ever been since our founding. And Cruz understands that, and there's a few others who understand that. And they're speaking to the American people. When Ted Cruz speaks, and when Ted Cruz spoke on the floor of the Senate, he wasn't speaking to the other senators. That wasn't what that's all about. He's speaking for liberty. And if you take the message of what Ronald Reagan did back in the Cold War, you know, Nathan Sharansky was in Russian prison, and he was in Russian prison for about 8 years, I think it was. And Sharansky said that the only thing that kept them encouraged to not give up was that they heard the words of Ronald Reagan speaking freedom from the shores of America, and they would tap these speeches down through code, Morse code and similar things, through the prison cells, and they believed that they were going to make it because America was going to ultimately speak for freedom. People don't understand the power of that. They think, oh, well, you know, you don't need to be doing this, but I'm telling you, when Ted Cruz is up there on the floor speaking for freedom, the American people hear it, the world hears it, and I think it goes way above and beyond the heads of most of the political class.
Well, I think you're right. I just, you know, I have, you know, I wonder, how do you, I mean, you're an ex-GOP county chair, and of course, you took some positions while you were in that position that weren't popular with the establishment in our own state.
Right.
So standing up for what you think is right is nothing new to you, and I appreciate that. But I just have to wonder, you know, is the GOP worth the trouble? I mean, what do we get out of them?
It's a good question. I mean, it's one that I think most of us who think like we do have struggled with, because we have to this point been told that we are in a two-party system, and I believe obviously the two-party system is more effective than having a third party which can water it down. But at the same time, we're losing as it is anyway. We keep putting up the wrong people. We're talking from presidential elections. We put the wrong people into positions, and we just go along and we give, when I say we, meaning the conservative base of the GOP, we give them so much power. The GOP would not have any elected positions without its conservative base, and yet I feel like they abuse us. They take advantage of us for our votes, and then they kick us to the curb. I don't know how long that can continue. I would prefer that we take over the Republican Party, but it's a challenge.
Yeah, to say the least. You know, I mean, we know what to expect from the Democrats, but we're really getting tired of getting stabbed in the back by the GOP. Got to take a quick break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside Tennessee. Little technical difficulty here. Sorry about that. Okay, well, I don't know what to tell you, but hey, I guess we're not on break. So we are back from break. This is Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. That thing is still spinning. It'll probably start all of a sudden in the middle of a conversation. So if it does, it's, you know, that's what happened. You know, the thing is, now you've...
Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. They pretty much declared war on conservatives within the party. And I don't know if
you saw... Hey, liberals, why don't you try rooting for your own damn country for a change?
There you go.
It's 6:42 p.m. Time for Steve Plato and his son Dylan to do the dishes. They talk about everything from the yuckiness of girls to the awesomeness of his soccer team. Sometimes they don't talk at all. Then, hey! The dreaded splash fight. It's dad o'clock, and it's the best time of the day. Because the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Phone number is 718-305-7176. And we're talking to Kevin Kukagee. Sorry about the little technical issue there. That happens sometimes. Kevin, are you're still with us?
I'm still with you, yes.
Okay, good. Back to the party a little bit. You know, I don't know if you heard about it or not, but it was announced the other day that the RNC wants to start the primaries in the Midwest. Basically, they came pretty much out and said it. They don't want Southern Republicans to have the impact on the election that they feel they've had in the past. So they pretty much snubbed us. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, they pretty much told us, and they don't like conservatives. So, you know, what do they think they're going to win without conservatives? And I'll be honest with you, in truth, just to be honest, I am now a member of the Constitution Party. I've given up on the GOP, just for the record. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that I won't vote for any Republican, but I don't have any faith in the party, so I went ahead and joined the Constitution Party. That may be a windmill, but I'm going to charge a different windmill for a change, tired of getting hit by the same one. But I just don't understand how people can continue to trust the GOP.
No, what you indicated, David, is they're going to commit suicide, and either they're going to discourage everybody that has conservative principles to leave the party, or they're going to face such a pushback. And I don't know, it's hard to tell right now how that's going to happen, but ultimately what I am entirely confident of is that those who are pushing the conservatives in the Tea Party or trying to push them out of the party, they're going to lose, whether it means that they're going to lose within the party or that a significant amount is going to leave the party, that they're forever, they become the third party, which is something that I've been thinking about for about a year now. I think they're either way. They are not in line with the majority of conservative thinkers in the country. They're not in line with the base. They, for some reason, they have this arrogance, this hubris to think that they can survive without the conservative base. And you can only reject them for so long, and it's going to pay dividends for us. It's going to hurt them. And it's a battle that I think we need to have. I think this battle needs to happen. It's been a long time in coming, and it's going to determine who's on what side. But you're right, we cannot keep giving ourselves and giving votes to candidates who do not uphold the conservative flag, who do not uphold principled conservatism. I even hesitate to say conservatism anymore because, you know, the GOP has misused that word now, and they all call themselves conservatives.
Well, Lamar called himself a conservative. I heard one of his ads the other day. I couldn't believe it. And it's funny, listening to his ads, he can't really talk about anything that he's done as senator. He has to go back to the time when he was governor and talk about what he did then. So, I mean, I think it's pathetic. And, you know, the sad thing is a lot of people don't understand what his record currently is, and they do, oh, well, he was a good governor, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just hoping that you know, I know we can do. We've got to do better than Lamar Alexander. I've kept you a little over time here, but I appreciate you sticking around. Just got a few minutes here, if you still got some time that you can
give us. I've got 2 minutes. Yep, 2 minutes, and I've got to pick up some children from dance.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to give you the last 2 minutes, and you just, whatever's on your mind, whatever's on your heart, let's hear it.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for not only having me on the program, but thank you for doing this program. I know that we've tried a couple of times since you launched the program to get me on here, and for schedule reasons haven't been able to, but every time we can have the Voices of Liberty speaking, and that as long as we have the freedom to speak this, I appreciate your courage in doing this. I appreciate the topics you cover. I appreciate the guests you have on the program. I hope your program continues to grow. I think it's a great thing that you're doing. And really, I've covered the subject matter, I think, thoroughly enough, so I don't want to step on your time either, but I just really wanted to end by thanking you, David, for what you're doing.
Well, hey, I want to thank you for your efforts. Thank you for coming on the show. I hope to have you again in the future, and we'll definitely have to have you back and get an update, if nothing else, on how it's going with the lawsuit.
I look forward to that. You just let me know. We'll come back on.
All right. Well, hey, thanks again, and you have a good night, and take care.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care. And let's go to Kurt. We've got him on the line here. Kurt, how are we doing tonight?
Oh, okay, Dave. Oops. Excuse me. Noise in the background there. It's my computer kicking in. Actually, I just walked in the door. I dialed the number so I could listen to your show while I was on the way home, and I just walked in the house.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, I know you've got another guest coming on, so you go ahead and take care of business, and if I need anything, I'll come back in.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll talk to you later. Appreciate you.
Okay.
That sounds right. That'll work. All right. Okay, we've got a couple minutes here before we're going to have to take a break. Just want to touch base on a couple things that we talked about earlier in the show. We talked about the textbook issue, and I'm not going to get through all of this before the break. I'm going to have some time between now and the time that our next guest, Representative Matheny, calls in. The textbook tattler. If you haven't seen one of these, you need to get your hands on them. And it's put out, I mentioned earlier, about this group of just average citizens with, I'm going to say, above average concern for our country and for our state. It's textbookadvocates.com, and they put out this newsletter called The Textbook Tattler, coming soon to a classroom near you. As a parent, you should know what your child is being taught in school. The Tennessee Department of Education is recommending social studies textbooks to your children's classroom. A group of responsible, hold on here just a second, a group of responsible, well-educated, and qualified parents reviewed those textbooks for content. The books featured here are a sampling. Take a look at what you will find in the books. And below that, it says, text of book is in red, and the reviewer's comments are in black. Now, before we talk about the review, understand that there were teachers that reviewed these books as well. So it was not just this concerned group of parents, and quite honestly, some of them are grandparents. It was not just them. Teachers were selected. But somehow or another, teachers overlooked a lot of these things. And it seems to be that they're not so much concerned with the content. They were given, okay, hey, here is the state standard for this topic. And so they were just looking at, okay, does this material, this textbook, does it meet the state standard? And apparently some things in the content that should have just really, really jumped out at them. I mean, if they knew anything about American history, if they knew anything about the world, what's going on in the world, it should have jumped out at them, but it didn't. But it did. Fortunately, it did jump out to this these well-educated and concerned parents who did the review. And like I say, remember, they weren't tasked. There wasn't some county agency or state agency said, hey, we would like some parents to review these books. No, that didn't happen. They took it upon themselves. because they know it's too, basically things are too important. These things are too important to just be trusted to politicians. So they took it upon themselves to get involved, to find out where the books were, because they did have, they were able to look at them. Now, they didn't necessarily make it easy for them to look at them, but they made sure they got their eyes on them. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about this some more. Don't go away. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Americans have known Tennessee as the volunteer state since the War of 1812. Now, Tennessee is leading the way in another major conflict, the war to keep America's identity, values, and freedoms intact. Even if you've never walked in Memphis or hiked the Blue Ridge Mountains, if you respect traditional American values, you should know about the Tennessee Action Council. Tennessee Action Council fights to preserve American values, defend our way of life, and protect the U.S. Constitution. This isn't just Tennessee's battle. It affects every American who loves our country and wants to pass the real America, unstained by progressive liberalism, along to future generations. No matter where you are in this magnificent country of ours, Tennessee Action Council is on your side and on America's side. Go to TN4Action.com. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com to volunteer for Tennessee and America. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com to stand for America now.
Good afternoon. For Talk Radio News Service, I'm Marissa Higdon. Migrants in the U.S. will send nearly $54 billion this year to Spanish-speaking Latin American countries, including Mexico. That's according to a new report by the Pew Research Center. The total value of remittances to Mexico will be about $22 billion, about 30% below 2006 peak levels. The total sent to other Latin American countries will be almost $32 billion, slightly above 2008 peak levels. The National Retail Federation estimates that 140 million people will be shopping for Christmas holiday gifts over the four-day weekend that begins Thanksgiving Day. The group expects nearly 33 million shoppers to shop on Thanksgiving. The group anticipates that the following day, Black Friday, will still be the biggest shopping day of the weekend, with an expected 97 million shoppers. And the U.S. Postal Service reports that it ended its 2013 fiscal year with a net loss of $5 billion. That, despite an $800 million increase in revenues and a roughly $9 billion reduction in operating expenses. Marissa Higdon, Talk Radio News Service, Washington.
There's no time to kill between the cradle and the grave. Father, time still takes a toll on every minute that you save. Legal tender's never gonna change the number on your days. The highest cost of living's dying, that's one everybody pays. So have it spent before you get the bill.
Oh, okay. Welcome back. We had another tech problem there. I apologize. Reading from the textbook Tatler that I mentioned before the break. All right. Government in America. This is from Pearson Education. What should governments do? Maintain a national defense. The reviewer's response, yes, as enumerated in the Constitution. Provide public goods and services, limited in the Constitution. Notice in red, which was the text of the book, they said nothing about limits on the, how many, what they can provide in terms of goods and services. Preserve order. When people protest in large numbers, government may resort to extreme measures to restore order. Now, when people protest in large numbers, government may resort to extreme measures. Reviewer's comments, accurate, not constitutional until laws are broken, and that's exactly right. But this says, this is what they're telling our kids, preserve order. When people protest in large numbers, government may resort to extreme measures to restore order. Socialize the young. This is in the textbook, socialize the young. Reviewer's comments, who do you want socializing your child? It's unconstitutional. And in red, it says collect taxes, reviewers' comments, very accurate, what they do best. Now, Magruder's American Government and Civics. What is government? Government is the institution through which a society makes and enforces its public policies. Government is made up of those people who exercise its powers and all those who have authority and control over the people. Authority and control over the people. So they're putting our kids in the mindset that it's the job of the government to have authority and control over the people, not that the government works for the people, not that the power comes from we the people. The public policies of a government are, in short, all of those things a government decides to do. This is what they're telling our kids. All of those things a government decides to do. Doesn't sound very constitutional to me. Public policies cover matters ranging from taxation, defense, education, crime, and health care to transportation, the environment, civil rights, and working conditions. Indeed, the list of public policy issues handled by government is nearly endless. So you take the first part of that paragraph. The public policies of a government are, in short, all of those things a government decides to do. No mention of constitutional limitations here. In the last sentence, indeed, the list of public policies issues handled by the government is nearly endless. Well, unfortunately, that's become true, but that's not the way it's supposed to be. Well, they're trying to teach our kids that's the way it's supposed to be. Recent changes. This is under the same textbook. The Soviet Union controlled Eastern Europe for four decades, but by the late 1980s, the Soviet Union had severe economic problems and a new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, was making reforms. As one reform, he gave Eastern Europe more freedom. The impact was dramatic. Eastern Europeans demanded political and economic reforms. By 1989, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, and Romania ended communist control of their governments and held free elections. In 1990, Bulgaria and Yugoslavia followed suit. Now, here is what's not mentioned. I did tell the truth, okay, but here's what they did not mention about the Soviet Union. 56 to 62 million unnatural deaths for the USSR overall, with 34 to 49 million under Stalin. At the war's end, the Soviet Union adopted a plunder policy of physically transporting and relocating East European industrial assets to the Soviet Union. That wasn't mentioned in the textbook. No experiments in communism, socialism have ever succeeded. China is offered up as an example of success, but Mao was responsible for over 70 million deaths. Historians Wang Chang and John Holliday provided that information. Historians agree that President Ronald Reagan's policies were instrumental in the collapse of the Soviet Union in freeing Eastern Europe from communist rule. And I've got to take a quick break here. Our friendly local pilot in command and GOP spokesman Duke Brooks calls himself a paleocon, and rightly so. Since it's clear that anti-communism is in his DNA, his parents were friends with Joe McCarthy, Bill Buckley, and Whitaker Chambers. So what would you expect? There's no truth to the rumor that he has a dartboard with Alger Hiss's picture on it, but you can get your weekly dosage of old-school conservatism, right-wing politics, American history, and hanger flying on Radio Free America with Duke Brooks, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. Let's go back to the newspaper here, the textbook Tattler, once again put out by the textbookadvocates.com. And American government and politics today, this is one of the articles below. And once again, I'm going to first read what's in the textbook, and then I will read responses by the review committee. Now, these are responses by the review committee made up of the parents and concerned citizens, not the teachers. The teachers didn't find a whole lot. Apparently, the only thing they found to complain about is they thought one section that was just a little too Christian-esque for them. Despite the civil rights movement and civil rights legislation, and despite the election of the first black president, many African Americans continue to feel a sense of injustice in matters of race, and this feeling is often not apparent to or appreciated by the majority of white America. Now, this is what's in the textbook. Now, is that something that fosters a, you know, let's all get along mentality? By no means. It's like, let's see how much race baiting we can do. And this is a response from the review committee. Is this a balanced approach? Is the unconfirmed injustice sensed by African Americans not just as prejudicial and objectionable as the lack of appreciation by white Americans? Next comment. Race. The president addressed racial profiling in ways no previous president could when one of the nation's preeminent scholars was arrested in his own home. The president said on national TV, the Cambridge police acted stupidly. Now, it's in reference to, I think his name was Lewis Gates. He was arrested back a couple years ago in an incident. And, of course, he made it all sound like it was just because of his race. Had nothing to do with what he appeared to be doing at the time. In February 2012, when unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a 28-year-old Community Watch organizer, the president said, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. Now, these are in our textbooks. These are the things that are put in our school textbooks. And here's the reviewer's response. Is it appropriate for a sitting president to interject his biased opinion into ongoing investigations? Is this appropriate to relay to our children without the complete background information on which to reach an informed opinion? Why are the professor and Trayvon Martin portrayed sympathetically while the Cambridge police and George Zimmerman are not afforded such deference? Good point. Once again, like I say, these are all in our textbooks, which, by the way, the State Textbook Commission, despite all the obvious problems, voted 5-2 to approve. 5-2. Now, there are 10 commissioners on the State Textbook Commission, but there were only 5 at the meeting where these books were approved. Let's see. Here's another one. Okay, Ancient World History, and this is from Houlton Miffin Harcourt is the name of the bookmaker. Jesus' Death. Jesus' growing popularity concerned Roman leaders. The Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, accused Jesus of defying the authority of Rome. Pilate arrested Jesus and sentenced him to be crucified. That's factually incorrect. If you look in John 19:4, I find no basis for a charge against him. That's what Pilate said. You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him. Actually, yes, the Romans, they gave the Pharisees the choice of whether or not who they wanted crucified, and the Romans did the actual crucifying. However, it was at the behest of the Pharisees. But what's in this history book is inaccurate. Let's see. Islamic bias. You decide if this is Islamic bias. Actually, you know what we're going to do? We need to take a quick break. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And I'm going to read a few more, and then Representative Judd Matheny should be meeting us here on air in just a few minutes.
The Internet's official rhino hunting safari.
Been looking for an online gathering place? You know, a familiar screen, does everything you're used to, except give you grief for being a conservative? You gotta try the Tea Party community. At TPC, you'll know how everything works from the very first minute, and you'll probably find a lot of friends who are already there. Organize, communicate, share ideas, upcoming events, pictures, and videos. The Tea Party community connects and empowers like-minded, politically conservative people like you. Sign up today at teapartycommunity.com.
Dr. Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and the worst injustice imaginable is the wrongful conviction of an innocent person. I'm Sam Thurman, host of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, Tuesdays 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, on conservativenationmedia.com. We take a look at what happens when innocent people go to jail as a result of bad evidence, wrongful prosecution, and dishonest witnesses. We use real cases of actual Americans who've been wrongfully convicted. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, Tuesdays 8 Eastern, 7 Central, conservativenationmedia.com.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. And Representative Matheny, I believe, has now joined us. And we will get back to the textbook tattler a little later. Representative Matheny, how are you tonight?
I'm here, David. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. Very good.
How we
glad
doing tonight, minus
here,
the frog?
Yeah, minus the frog. I've been speaking three times a day already. It's starting to get to me. So,
well, you're in demand. And hey, we appreciate you coming on.
Hey, I'm proud to do it, and I am on a cell phone, so if something happens, I'll call you right back.
Okay.
Should be in good shape, my man.
Okay, now let me see if I can get this right for once. The Joint Legislative Oversight Advisory Committee, correct?
Just Advisory Committee, Joint Legislative Advisory Committee.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, we're just going by JLAC.
Had their second meeting November 12th. Right, had their second meeting November 12th.
Yes, and we looked at, we had a fiscal report, a fiscal review report on refugee resettlement in the state of Tennessee. It was presented to us, and we did not accept it as complete because it really didn't deal with the issue of cost shifting, which is basically unfunded mandates in the refugee resettlement program coming from the federal government. And what I mean by that is the feds are deciding how many refugees they'll send to Tennessee, and they send them, and private charities accept those refugees for a profit. The state of Tennessee has no say-so over it, yet they're consuming a large amount of resources in Tennessee as far as medical coverage, education, temporary assistance for needy families and other social programs. So we really, that's what we're trying to dial down on. The report we received was incomplete, primarily due to the fact that the federal government would not provide the information that the state asked for. So that creates a whole new set of problems, but once again legitimizes the reason for our committee in Tennessee state government, which is to call attention to federal issues that are infringing upon our rights and liberties, which includes our budgets. So we're still at the refugee resettlement issue very hard, and we're going to commission a new portion of that study. And then also at the last meeting we looked at, we just sort of did a first blush on the Constitutional Convention. We looked at the two areas of an Article 5 convention, and of course one is for the federal government to amend the Constitution, and the other enables the citizens of Tennessee to do it, or the citizens of America. And we're just talking about the legality, the procedures, the precedents involved in those, and a little bit about the potential pitfalls of both of them. One is the federal government's not going to correct itself, we know that, but it's also, I think, very dangerous for the citizens to rise up and have a constitutional convention just due to the fact that the liberals will do anything, lie, cheat, or steal, to win. And we can't, it's a difficult thing to risk, so we're just looking at it from all sides. And then also, Dave, we talked a little bit more about the bilateral session of Congress, which, as you know, I'm putting most of my effort into right now to try to make happen. And the bilateral session is just simply a meeting of our federal legislators meeting with the state of Tennessee lawmakers to discuss relevant political issues.
I definitely need to do that. Before we talk about the Constitutional Convention or the bilateral, I want to go back to the physical review issue a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You know, I was there, and granted, I don't remember everything, but I noticed that some of the legislators took the review committee to task for some of their assumptions. And if I remember correctly, essentially the assumptions were that refugees coming into Tennessee use the same amount of state resources as an average citizen, and they contribute the same to the tax base. And they were challenged by a couple of legislators on those assumptions. And what's your thought on that?
Yeah, rightly so. I think some more effort could have been put into that part of the presentation. And you said it, Dave. Long story short, they equated a refugee, which is different than an immigrant. A refugee is someone that normally is escaping from some type of political turmoil. They're unsafe in their home area, and we do feel for them. But when they come to this country and they're illiterate, they have health problems, they are not properly assimilated, it takes years. It takes 5 years to learn to become an American citizen if you do everything right as a refugee. And there's just no way that they're unofficial, and therefore their citizenship is the same as a natural-born Tennessee citizen. And they did not even take into account in that study that even one refugee had ever been incarcerated in the state of Tennessee. And we know that's false. The largest sex trafficking ring almost in the country was busted in Nashville, the Somali ring. And we know many of them have been to jail. There's a lot of incarceration costs, a lot of health care costs that come from a lifetime of malnutrition, a lifetime being exposed to chronic diseases that Tennesseans don't have. And we're talking about AIDS, HIV, tuberculosis, and issues such as that are being brought into this country. And we've had outbreaks in Tennessee from the refugee population. So I am as disappointed as I was with the report. I do cut them a little bit of slack on half of it because the federal government has been uncooperative. And I try to understand in my mind, excuse me, that not everybody understands this issue perhaps as well as some of us do. And but now I'm confident Fiscal Review understands it much better and will come forward with a proposal for us. Because it's just important that we get the right numbers and we get the facts out.
I understand they can't control the fact that the federal government didn't give them the information they needed to give a full, thorough report. But, you know, just based on the concerns that some of the legislators raised, I don't think they gave necessarily the best they could have given from the state perspective. I understand there's certain things they couldn't have gathered, but I think they could have done a better job with what they had.
Oh, you're right, and Representative Reagan was very good in quizzing the group on statistical samples that they took, and it turns out they didn't really take any. They just figured, well, there's 55 or 60,000 refugees here, and each one of them is just like another Tennessee citizen, so whatever the average Tennessee citizen makes in a lifetime and pays in taxes in a lifetime, we're going to give the refugees that same number. Well, that's inaccurate because about a third of the refugees that have come in are over working age. They're past retirement age in Tennessee. So they're not having a lifetime of earnings. They're having the exact opposite. They're having end-of-life drain on resources. And we don't want to disenfranchise, or we don't want to not allow somebody to be taken care of, but we have other people that need to be taken care of first. There's 10,000 children on the developmental disabilities waiting list in Tennessee that are Tennessee citizens. We've got 11 and 12% unemployment in many counties. These resources that are being used to bring refugees over and settle them and pay for them to become American citizens could be better used at the present time on our local citizenry. And that's one thing that once we get the fiscal price tag nailed down, that we're going to be able to, I think, make that argument and let the General Assembly, the taxpayer of Tennessee through their elected representatives, make the decision on prioritizing our dollars. And that's our overall objective here. And it just takes a long time to get there.
Yeah, well, you've got to take care of your own first, that's for sure. And like, you know, you mentioned the different diseases and issues that they come over here with. You know, okay, it may be a federal program that brings them over here, but not to consider the impact. And really, I don't understand that. I mean, you know, if you had an outbreak like that in a local school district or something along, they would expect some sort of quarantine, but we're bringing these people over here like this on our dime to make it that much worse.
Now, there's some legitimate risks there, and we are trying to identify them and deal with them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it could definitely be a nightmare, and I'll tell you another nightmare. You know, one of the worst nightmares that can befall American today is identity theft. If it happens to you, it may take months or even longer to recover from it, if you can recover at all. Don't let it happen to you. Protect yourself in advance. Sign up today with LifeLock. LifeLock is a lot more than just your standard credit monitoring service. LifeLock helps to protect your personal information using a combination of data surveillance techniques and outstanding member services 24/7, 365. There's really nothing that comes close to LifeLock. To protect your identity with LifeLock and get 10% off their great service, go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the LifeLock banner. Network may not cover all transactions, and the scope may vary. That's conservativenationmedia.com, and then click on the LifeLock banner. You'll be very glad that you did. Jeff, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media.
Whether you're on active duty, a veteran, or just admire American Armed Forces, there's no better place to get the widest variety of militaria than at Highlands Militaria. Highlands Militaria is one of America's premier distributors of Fox tactical gear and outdoor products. Veteran-owned and operated, Highlands Militaria offers new and used uniforms and insignia from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and today. With an emphasis on airborne and special operations insignia, gear, collectibles, and uniforms. If you need to replace a cherished badge or unit patch, or just want to gear up for your next outdoor adventure, go to Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria, where you'll find the best supply of the military gear you need. Shipping is always free with one-day handling time, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria. And thank you for your service.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're speaking with Representative Judd Matheny. We were talking about the fiscal reviews report of the refugee resettlement program here in Tennessee. Now, Representative Matheny, you mentioned that they are going to go back and basically go back to the drawing board on this, but obviously somebody is going to have to contact the federal government. You know, the fiscal review board can't necessarily get anything out of that.
I will be doing that and quizzing them as to why those questions weren't answered timely. I will also submit questions that fiscal review needs, and we're even going to try to invite somebody from the State Department's Office of Refugee Resettlement to come down and perhaps talk to our committee in the future. So we are going to continue to turn stones over and bring attention to the issue until the questions are satisfied.
Right, right. Okay, now these are every 90 days. They could be every month if needed, but they're going to be at least every 90 days, these meetings?
That's correct, yes, sir, once a quarter at a minimum.
Okay, and so we got one for February, or do you have one in January?
We'll probably most likely, let's see, probably mid-February, Dave, and we'll have another one sometime around the second week of February, and it will be on a day that government operations is meeting during the normal committee process, but we'll have we'll revisit some old issues, and we'll be talking about some new issues. And
are you getting any support from – I'm sorry.
No,
on this issue, on the cost, are you getting any support from anybody else within the government, within our state government? I mean, do you have anybody, let's say, out of lieutenant governor's office or governor's office, anybody like that, that it's also concerned and you think might help encourage the federal government to provide? Or is this, are you going to be just
not
giving
yet
it your best shot?
Well, I am going to go to the two speakers and ask them for their help. And in fairness, they're not aware totally of the situation with regards to the federal government thumbing their nose at us again on this issue. And so it would be very helpful if I have their bully pulpit and help them get this issue solved. But I'm prepared to do it not unilaterally, but on behalf of the committee and with members of the committee. So we'll move forward regardless of any help we receive or any offer of support. But I'm confident that once the lieutenant governor's office understands that the federal government would not answer the state's questions, that he'll be on board with us to, at a minimum, help us get questions answered in a timely manner this time.
Hope
I'm confident,
so.
Governor Rams, for that.
Yeah.
And
now,
you know, go ahead, man.
You're getting ready to talk, I think, about the Constitutional Convention portion.
Well, I think I kind of already hit that for the most part. We just broached it. You were at the meeting. We brought in a resident expert on the Constitution, Dr. John Vile from MTSU. He is a former head of the political science department and now heads the Honors College up at MTSU. And he's actually my former constitutional law professor from two lifetimes ago, and he is sort of the pinnacle of his professional life's work has been on amending the Constitution and the precedents for amending it, the different attempts made at amending it, and he's written numerous books about that. And he was there to just tell us in a holistic view the good, the bad, and the ugly, the various possibilities, and where the legal ability to amend the Constitution came from and why it was there. And it was a very interesting conversation. It's the first of many that not only our state government's going to have, but many are going to have. There's a lot of national organizations that are hosting symposiums in states to talk about a constitutional convention. You know, Mark Levin's book, which is very popular today, talks about a convention of the states, and there's some disagreement as to whether that is an Article 5 constitution or is that something totally out of left field, and it's not the states coming together as per the Constitution, but it's the states coming together in a separate movement outside the Constitution with a very narrow scope of amendments. So it's a fascinating time in American politics. It's unfortunate we have to be here because it takes away from so many other things we could be doing. But it's something we have to do. We have to face what's in front of us and deal with it because it's not going to go away. It's only going to get worse. And we're soon to pass a point, in physics you would call it a point of singularity where you go so far it gets irreversible. And we're not too far from that. I mean, it could be decades, it could just be years. But we're a very resilient country. We have a lot of reserve power, but it's being drained slowly and surely every day. And we've got to turn the ship around in many respects.
Well, you know, I don't know. Amending the Constitution, bottom line is they don't follow it now. The key to having the federal government follow it is actually the state governments. So no matter what you do, if you don't have state governments that will stand up to the federal government, I don't care what amendments you pass, I don't care what you do in an Article 5.
Amen, sir.
If you don't have a state government that will stand up, and if you don't have citizens in those states that demand their state government stands up, I don't care what you pass. It's not going to mean anything.
Well, you're right, and you know that's another huge component of this Joint Legislative Advisory Committee is to educate fellow legislators, is to educate me. I don't know everything by any means. I think I know more about states' rights and sovereign rights and the constitutional precedents in those than do many of my colleagues. I'm not the best expert up there. But this is a good opportunity to educate more of my colleagues about what their powers are and that they need to exercise them. And it's not against the law, and it's not something they need to be afraid of to execute those powers.
Well, you know, to save our country, they're going to have to because, as you said, the route we're on. We can't keep going the way we're going. We can't do it financially. We can't do it culturally with all the different things. I mean, we're becoming, we're very divided. That's not a secret to anybody. But, you know, there's things that have been mentioned and things that we're facing now that 5-10 years ago, nobody would have ever thought.
Would have never thought it. And many of the things that we're facing now, Dave, I had no idea until people that needed me to know came and educated me. And, you know, I had no idea about some of the battles that I was right in the middle of but oblivious to 5 years ago. And, Islam spreading into our society is a prime case of that. And it takes a long time to get your arms around the magnitude of that issue. And then the answer is so simple. It's just basically that if you take Christ out of our way of life, something's going to fill that void, and it's Islam. And it's just that simple. It really is.
And I don't know why more people don't see that. If you look at the Middle East, I would challenge anybody to name a country in the Middle East, and they're all Muslim with the exception of Israel. Name a country in the Middle East that you'd like to emulate. Name a country in the Middle East that you want America to be like. Name a country in Europe that has allowed all this these Islamists to immigrate into their country and to basically tear away their culture, take away their own culture and replace it with an Islamic culture. You know, do you want America to be like a places in France that are no-go zones for the cops?
Heck no, and I've been to those places. I've been to them in France and Belgium and London, and believe it or not, we have a town called Dearborn, Michigan, here in the United States.
Dearborn is Stan.
That's right, and it's very, very similar to many of the European communities that I toured, where those communities have lost their identity, they've lost their local governance, and they've literally been renamed, you know, New Morocco and New Mogadishu and New Kenya. And these countries, I mean, right at the heart of some of the most ancient cities of Europe are being changed. We're seeing textbooks being written that rewrite our history, either through blatant lies or through obvious disregard of the facts. And they want us only to concentrate on the present. And that's so dangerous, because it's easy to mold people when they don't have a moral compass or something to fall back on. And when someone rewrites our history, the next generation that comes up doesn't know how exceptional we truly are in this country. Now, importantly, there's so many fights out there.
Yeah, and I'm sure you followed at least somewhat the textbook commission issue.
I was kind of a Johnny-come-lately on that in many respects, because I've been working on these other issues so much. But in the last 8 or 9 weeks, I've become very involved in the textbook issue. I've been involved very much in the Common Core issue all along, which is closely related to the textbook issue. And I'm proud to say that we've made some headway in textbook selection in Tennessee. We have not scored a victory yet. But we've made some headway, and it's just a matter of time. More than anything, we brought our attention to the weaknesses in the system. And myself and Senator Mike Bell, my counterpart, Chairman of Government Operations in the Senate, we're going to work to help redo the textbook commission and put new folks on there and put new oversight from the General Assembly into the books that are done. And so we've identified a lot of weaknesses and ways we can fix them.
Well, let me ask you this, and obviously that needs to be done, but just earlier in the program, I read the letter that was sent by Senator Gresham and Senator Bell in reference to the Textbook Commission, and it said that the State Board of Education and the State Textbook Commission were created by the General Assembly. It is our responsibility to fix the problems when we find them. These are serious matters, blah, blah. Anyway, bottom line is, you know, I'm sure there will be legislation proposed, as you mentioned, but what would stop the General Assembly, as soon as it convenes, or even in an emergency meeting prior, to put on hold those textbooks that were selected? I mean, we know something's wrong here. Is it not possible to say, look, we're going to override the commission, which out of 10 people on that commission?
Oh, I think absolutely we can do it. I don't think that's going to be a problem, having that legislation filed. And the same exact argument, Dave, can be made with Common Core, which was instituted administratively. We're planning on a piece of legislation this year to stop Common Core. And the textbook legislation would be no different. And it's just basically to recall the decision that was made by an unelected body.
Yeah, and that's outrageous.
It is outrageous. And I want to talk to you about something pretty cool, too. How much time do we have?
I've got to go to a break, but when I come back, we've got about, you know, 12-14 minutes.
Okay,
let me
great.
Take a break.
I want to talk to you about another initiative we have going on here in Tennessee.
All right. Hey, don't go away. We'll be right back on Inside Tennessee.
If you love America, you're among friends here.
Wildfires burn millions of acres each year. And each year, wildland firefighters like Fire Chief James Hall battle to contain them. But they can't do it alone.
A single ember that escapes from a wildfire can travel more than a mile. It can ignite and destroy your home, your community, or more. That single ember can be just as dangerous as the wildfire itself. But you can do something firefighters can't. You can act now to prepare your home and your community for wildfire. You can reduce the risk. Do your part. Go to fireadapted.org.
Get fire adapted. Learn what you can do now to reduce wildfire damage later at fireadapted.org. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council. Learn more at fireadapted.org.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm back.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're speaking with Representative Judd Matheny. And, Judd, you had a new topic you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, I do. But first, let me tell you that your bumper music sounds like my iPod, man. I love it.
Well, good.
You've got Simple Man and Mama Cried. Songs I've got on mine that I listen to every day, so that's good taste there.
Thank you.
Yeah, something new that we're working on. It's not really new, and you've probably heard about this, and you and I are fortunate enough to get to visit occasionally personally. And tomorrow, Tuesday the 19th, I have my first official meeting with ammunition and ammunition component manufacturers in Tennessee. And Ronnie Barrett at Barrett Manufacturing, the world-famous 50-caliber sniper rifle inventor, is hosting the meeting. And what we're going to try to do is come up with a way to strengthen the ammunition manufacturing capabilities of the state of Tennessee. And the manufacturers we have coming are from various levels of the industry. Some are literally mom-and-pop operations, and others are mediocre size. We don't really have any super large manufacturers here other than a federal manufacturer. And then we have some component manufacturers coming too, some bullet makers and primer makers. We have some folks representing the powder industry that are coming. And also some pretty innovative folks are coming. There's one gentleman that's bringing a plastic bullet forward that is very dense and is excellent for target practice and some other potentials. And he also has a synthetic gunpowder that can be made in a laboratory that is rivals normal gunpowder. So bringing all these people together and looking at the various weaknesses of ammunition manufacturing in Tennessee, I want to create a low-interest type of loan program in Tennessee that would help prop up the industry in its weakest points so that everyone can benefit from it. And then anybody that's a recipient of this money and this assistance from the state, which ideally would also be some fast-tracking assistance through EPA processes through the state, basically EPA issues that are handled by the state, the memorandums of understanding. The one caveat would be that these manufacturers would have to sell to the citizens of the state of Tennessee first. A citizen would get first right to any ammunition that they made before it was shipped to a third party, another state or another organization outside the state, or even a commercial venture within the state. So the average sportsman would always be able to be first in line to be able to get what ammunition that we could produce, or something along those lines. But I want Tennessee to become as vertical as possible in the actual manufacture of ammunition. And I think there's a groundswell of public support for that. If I can come up with a sound plan and we can get sound players and come up with a real feasible option, I think there'll be – I know the state has the money, and I'm not advocating that the state give the money away. I'm advocating a low-interest loan program where the state would be made whole again. And So I'm pretty excited about that, and you know, everything always sounds easier than it actually is, and I know something like this would be very difficult to do, if for no other reason than the supply chain, to be able to make this ammunition. But if we can enable a powder manufacturer to exist here, and a primer manufacturer, and a brass manufacturer, and a bullet manufacturer, and all these companies can be strong and feed each other in order to come up with that final manufactured product, various calibers, and I mean all the way from 22 to heavy hunting game rifles, then I think it's a win-win for all of us. So I'm going to sink my teeth. I've got a lot of projects going on, but it's something else, once again, that I'm very, very passionate about. And,
well, I love the sound of that. That sounds like a great plan. Now, every year, the state government, I mean, as I understand it, we spend money to bring other industries here, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and I don't know, I think, was it today or is it tomorrow that the governor is going to, you know, they're having debates on the budget for the upcoming year? You know, the governor's laying out what he wants.
It's all last week and all this week. It's every day. There's a couple of different departments before the governor. And like today it was finance and administration, and I'm not sure who it is tomorrow, but yes, this is going on as we speak.
And this plan would not so much draw industries from other states as it would create industries from within Tennessee.
That's correct. It would either help an existing one to grow, or it would enable a new one to spring up here. And it doesn't have to be major. We're not talking about 100, 200 person entities. You know, it could be helping four or five companies that employ 12 to 18 people apiece pop up. And you talk to an ammunition manufacturer right now, and they'll say, well, I can only get powder now and then. I can only get brass now and then. Well, if whenever they needed it, for the most part, they could order the amount of powder and brass they needed in order to fill their orders and have a reliable production capacity, then it's going to enable a powder manufacturer and a brass manufacturer to also exist, because they're going to have a guaranteed.
Right.
My heart tells me if enough people get involved in this that really care about a good outcome, just like many other things in politics, that we can be successful with this. And if we can get an interest rate on some money that's cheaper than the bank, and a better repayment program perhaps than they get out here in the commercial industry, and some fast-tracking through environmental issues and revenue issues and things like that. And what fast-tracking basically means is that the state really tries to help make it happen. It's just like, you know, go out and do it all on your own, and we'll send you as many notices as we can to permit you and fee you. It's like a couple of folks from the state walk hand in hand with these businesses, help get up and moving and operational, and then basically just let them go once they're in compliance. So I'm excited about it.
With these low interest loans you're describing, is that different than what the state normally does when it tries to bring in other businesses? Because I get the impression a lot of times, you know, we're not just offering low interest loans. We're offering all kinds of
taxes. No, we're
not.
Many times it's franchise and excise tax credits that the state offers. It's basically foregone revenue. For instance, if a major industry came in, they can say, look, we'll hire 60 people, then the state could say, well, we can give you $4,500 tax credit for 15 years for a full-time job. Bring in, so if you bring in 60 people, you know, get $250,000 off of franchise and excise taxes every year for 15 years. And so the state can say, we'll put $7 million in business or $8 million in business, but really they're foregoing revenue. And so that would be different in this regard, because I'm not sure these businesses are going to be large enough to truly make any difference to the state to forego revenue or not. What these businesses need is a helping hand to get started. Because they're literally from scratch businesses, or they're businesses that are, for lack of a better term, they've been bastardized by many government entities and many citizens because they're ammunition, firearm related. So I think a low interest loan that, 1% to 2%, something like that, where someone had a generous repayment program over 10 or 15 years, then that there'd be some potential there. And, you know, my gut tells me we're somewhere in the $12 to $15 million range is the amount of money we need to talk about for this fund. And, but 10 years from now, I expect all the money to be paid back and with interest and the state to be made whole, not for the state to make a profit, but for the tax-paying citizen to be made whole, that the amount of money that they invested in this, had it grown interest in, you know, the state's account, that would still be paid the same way as if it would just be basically surplus money being put to work instead of being
This will create not just the jobs directly for the people that work at these, but you're going to have added transportation jobs. If you're talking ammunition, obviously you're going to use more cardboard because you put them, you know, the boxes you put them in.
Not just that. I mean, absolutely all the secondary jobs you create. But like TWRA, a lot of their funding and almost all of the funding for their public gun ranges that they build and maintain comes from the 10-cent ammunition tax. And when there's no ammunition to be had, those taxes aren't collected, and then therefore TWRA can't maintain public shooting ranges. They can't open new shooting ranges. They can't hold 300 safety classes any longer. So just the idea of making millions of rounds of additional ammunition available every year and just paying the normal tax that is normally put on that ammunition of 10 cents a box makes other parts of state government whole and keeps firearms education in place, firearms training in place, and does many, many things. So, you know, when we do a fiscal review study on this, I'm going to make sure that they pay this one proper attention also, because there's a lot of hidden benefits that I want to make sure are expressed.
I don't know how anybody could be against this one. I mean,
I've never tried to do anything like this, but... We didn't think anybody would be against our bilateral session of Congress either, remember?
Well,
learned that as good as you think an idea is, there's somebody on the receiving end of it that thinks it's equally a bad idea. And you make none of the shots that you don't take. This is something that I can defend in my sleep. I can build it with passion, and I can deliver it to the citizens of Tennessee with passion. And, you know, I'd like to be able to look at my kid who's 12 years old and tell him, you know what, your kids are going to have a source of ammunition now because we're doing it from A to Z in Tennessee. We're not relying on Israel for powder and Czechoslovakia for brass and bullets whenever we can get a lead shipment out of the EPA somewhere. We're doing it ourselves here. And that is my goal, to do it as vertically as we can within the state of Tennessee. And then I'll be prepared to file any legislation to complement this program once we decide as a group where the best bang for our buck part of the fund can be had. So.
Yeah. Well, I wish you luck on that one. You definitely got my support on that one. I don't think it might not be as hard to sell as you think. I mean, especially here in Tennessee, who wouldn't want more access to ammo?
Well, I think the biggest hurdle is going to be with bean counters in the state, and especially the ones that, you know, could give a flip, whether it's about ammunition or manufacturing shoes or tires. They're just looking at the number of venues. And there's a lot of competition for surplus money, and we're fortunate Tennessee's sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars of surplus right now. And if we can put some of that money to work without losing any of the interest that accrues over a period of time and create jobs, it's going to take a good argument to beat it.
Got to try it. Hey, Judd, I really appreciate you being with us, and thanks for all you do, and we'll have you back again before too long, but we're just about out of time. Thanks again, and take care.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your listeners, too. Bye-bye.